I've been trying to finish like the first few days I was here in PI this week. So it's about the EMISI parameter and the T-MAN complexifier in loop quantum gravity. And it's some work that just appeared this morning on the archive that I did with Jibril Benachour, that's a postdoc in somewhere in China. So I always get confused about the EMISI parameter and trying to understand what it really means mathematically, physically, in loop quantum gravity. So the problem, in some sense, the issue is that loop quantum gravity, well, it's a proposal for quantum gravity. It quantizes, takes into account the three fundamental constants, C, H bar, and the Newton gravity constant. But then it also introduces this new parameter gamma, which is the EMISI parameter. So the question is it a new fundamental constant of quantum gravity? Maybe it's a new constant that we should measure experimentally. It needs to be fixed. Obviously, many other possible ways to see it. We can also imagine that it's a coupling constant that will flow under renormalization, or maybe just a regulator that we will need to send to zero, or some like to fix it to some imaginary value I. Or here I will propose some other fancy interpretation of the EMISI parameter, which will become a time parameter along the trajectories of a geometry. So mainly I will start by explaining you the many definitions of EMISI parameter in loop quantum gravity. And I will focus afterwards on the main definition, on the original definition of the EMISI parameter as the parameter of a canonical transformation of a phase space, which is generated by what is called the complexifier. And I will show that it forms a nice algebra, which I called CVH, by complexifier, volume, and Hamiltonian constraint. And I will show you how this algebra is realized in cosmology, in standard cosmology, and then it's a slight modification to apply it to loop quantum cosmology. And then I will finish with some wild speculations about how to use this CVH algebra in loop quantum gravity and try to get some implementation of the local dynamics of loop quantum gravity. So yeah, the whole issue, as I said, with the EMISI parameter is that it has many roles in quantum gravity, which comes from many different definitions of the EMISI parameter, which sometimes causes confusion because people refer to different definitions of the EMISI parameter, which are not necessarily equivalent. So the first definition, which is the original one, is that it's a classical canonical transformation which defines the choice of variables for quantum gravity, so the HTK-Barbero connection. So if we start with the variables for canonical gravity in terms of a triad and the existing curvature, then we can do some canonical transformation and define the HTK-Barbero connection, which is built from the spin connection of a triad plus a term in the exercise curvature. So and there's the EMISI parameter. So this canonical transformation, this change of fundamental variables, is generated by the T-MAN complexifier, T-MAN because that's who introduced it in quantum spin dynamics, one of the first papers I read on quantum gravity, which introduced the first quantumization of the Hamiltonian constraint. So this is the complexifier and generates shift in the EMISI parameter. So what I mean is that if you look at the flow induced by the Poisson bracket with the complexifier on the basic variables, it will simply shift the EMISI parameter and rescale the triad. But that's not so important. So the key property of why this works is that the spin connection as a function of the triad commutes with the complexifier. And that's really what's the little magic that makes everything work. And this is a slightly non-trivial property, which is annoying to check, which makes nice calculations.
So it works as a rescaling of the triad variables?
Yes.
And you said it's not so important, why?
Oh, this, because in the end we'll take as variables the triad, the unrescaled triad, E, and the HTK-Barbero connection, and we'll just put gamma in the Poisson bracket. So, yeah, here there's a little gamma, and this is the Henry scale triad, and that's the variable we use. So you kind of forget that there's a rescaling there. But all this really comes from the complexifier simply being the dilatation on the so it's a very simple observable in the end. So the second rule of the MZ parameter is that as a cutoff, so some kind of regulator of the theory. So the canonical transformation is something which is purely classical. And then loop quantum gravity not only chooses to work with the Ashtekar-Barabur connection, but it also chooses a specific set of observables which have a holonomies. So, and when you look at the holonomies, you exponentiate the Ashtekar-Barabur connection. And what it does is that, well, I forgot to write it. Okay, so, yeah. I'm saying you look at the holonomies of the Ashtekar-Barabur connection along some curves, see? And it's ordered the integral of the connection along the curve, so something like that. And basically, when gamma is a real parameter, you see that it's going to act like a kind of compactification of the exquisite curvature. So the exquisite curvature is something that can vary all over R, but this is a periodic function of K. So it's kind of going to be in some kind of effective compactification. So one way to see it is to do an actual calculation of the holonomy and see how it realizes some cutoff of the curvature. So a simple calculation is to take a single loop in the hypersurface. And what I considered here is, it's a rather old calculation by Samuel. In a paper where he was arguing that the Ashtekar-Barabur connection was not a good variable because it was not a pullback of a space-time connection, and so it depended on the embedding. Now, after all that time, I got to consider this property as a nice property of the Ashtekar-Barabur connection, meaning that it's going to encode some information on the space-time embedding of your hypersurface. So, how your hypersurface is embedded in the space-time, and so some information on the near geometry, the near space-time geometry. So, what we do here is that we take a loop, and in the flat space-time, but we can embed it different ways. You have a loop, you can embed it to the flat hypersurface, you can embed it into various hyperboloids of various curvature. And you will see that if you compute the holonomy of that. Of that loop, it will depend, of course, on the curvature of the hyperboloid and on the size of the loop, but it's going to be some cosine function. So if you were hoping to get the information on the curvature of your hyperboloid from that measure, from the holonomy, when you see that it has some periodicity, some awkward periodicity, but yeah, it's still periodic. And so this periodicity acts like you can interpret it as a certain cutoff in curvature, meaning that different curvatures, very high curvatures, will give the same result as a low curvature. So if you measure a holonomy, you will try to, if you try to reconstruct the space from that, you will say, I will maybe choose the lowest curvature radius. And so you kind of ignore all these higher excitations for loop quantum gravity. So in some sense, that's one of the reasons usually I interpret when Carlo or others say that in spin form models, in the hyperreal model for real MZ parameter, it always gives a finite result, always interpreted because as coming from the fact that, yeah, you have this cutoff given by the MZ parameter, and that's really what regulates the theory and makes all the transition amplitude finite. Okay,
unless gamma is prime, because then the pullback of the
That's why I said a real MZ parameter. Right. Yeah, I keep it real in this talk. Yeah. Then it quickly another way to see the MZ parameter is simply a new coupling constant in general relativity. So it almost has nothing to do, in some sense, with the two first definition of MZ parameter. So you see it as a new term in the Palatini action, which was introduced by Holst. And if it's a coupling constant, then you can compute a flow of this coupling constant under the renormalization group. Actually, the only calculation I know where they renormalize the MZ parameter is some calculation by Simone Speciale and Dario Benedetti. There's a couple of papers where they look at the flow of the MZ parameter and the cosmological constant. In all of our approaches, like spin forms, actually the MZ parameter is so much encoded in the details of a model, it's actually hard to see or to imagine how to normalize it. But it must. I mean, it's a coupling constant, it must run. So, let's ignore my remark. And so as a new coupling constant, they came like other interpretation, but very related to that definition of an MZ parameter as some topological parameter, very similar to the theta angle in QCD. And you realize it also controls the coupling to fermions because it controls the fluctuation of the torsion. And it's related to some to CP violation induced by loop quantum gravity. And the final definition of an MZ parameter, which is often the one that people focus on, is that it defines the area and volume gap in the usual loop quantum gravity theory. Meaning that if you look at the spectrum of the area and of the volume, gamma will appear as a global scale factor in front of that. And that's really due to the simple quantization scheme to the gamma here in the Poisson bracket between the triad and the connection, which comes into as a factor in front of the triad. And since all geometrical observables are constructed from the triad, like the areas and the volumes, it will appear simply in front of all the geometrical observables. So I usually get confused about all these different roles. And the only thing that really comes out of all this definition is that it seems to be really a crucial parameter in loop quantum gravity, which we must understand better. So here, I came back to the origins, and I will define the immunism parameter as a parameter of a canonical transformation induced by the complexifier.
But you were only allowed to take real values, even if it's running or not, the immunity
problem. I like real values. Yeah. It's a canonical transformation, so you can do whatever you want. But then, when you're going to quantize and the connection was real at the beginning, like if you want to avoid all problems with reality condition, you keep it real. But then I think at the end I think I will say something about a complex value. Yeah. So here in that work, I decided to focus on the CVH algebra, which is formed by the complexifier, the volume, and the Hamiltonian constraint. So this is the Hamiltonian constraint written in the triad and connection variables. And this is the definition of a volume. And a rather lengthy calculation simplifies a lot and gives some very simple Poisson brackets between these variables.
So and C is
the complexifier, which is the integral of E, the triad times the exception curvature. Yeah. So this is just an SL2 algebra. So I remember when I was told about this this algebra, it was right at the beginning of my PhD in 2000 in Imperial College with Lee. It was the first thing he told me about loop quantum gravity, and he told me it had it was encoding something fundamental. And then I forgot about it all these years, but I'm back to it. And why I really like it is that it's one of the only algebras that we consider in loop quantum gravity that contains the Hamiltonian constraint. So it's going to tell you something about the dynamics for once. So it's something very important. And also, if you look at that paper, the quantum spin dynamics number one and number two by Thomas, then it was one of the essential criteria that he had. He was saying that he was going to try to preserve this algebra. Well, he didn't say it in these terms, but that's how I interpret what he wrote. He's going to use this as some constraint to test the different quantization scheme for the complexifier, the Hamiltonian constraint, and the volume. So really, his definition of a complexifier operator was as the commutator of the volume and his proposal for the Hamiltonian constraint. And then he used this quantum complexifier to try to generate with big rotations and other things in loop quantum gravity. But then it got very
You're thinking of the Hamiltonian or the densities for this algebra?
So it's integrated.
So it's just integrated. So it's really just the Hamiltonian.
But it works with the densities.
what would be the Gauss constraint? What would be the?
Oh, they are all gauge invariant. So I didn't bother about the. By gauge, you mean the SU2, the Gauss law. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. No.
And so if you integrate the diff, you also decouple.
Yeah. OK, so it's a very simple algebra. So the talk is going to be rather simple. So I will apply this algebra to usual cosmology and see what happens. So I take the homogeneous and isotropic cosmology, which I couple with a massless scalar field, so as simple as you can get. So there's 2 degrees of freedom.
Can I just ask the previous question? I didn't understand the answer. What happened to the Gauss constraint?
All of these are gauge invariant. So
you've already implemented it, is it?
Yeah.
So this is after
implemented it, or
okay.
Yeah, if you want, it's simply decoupled.
Okay.
But H is here, is a total Hamiltonian integrated over, or?
It's the Hamiltonian constraint and I integrate it over it, over the hypersurface, yes.
So lapsus 1.
If you want, yeah.
Or I can choose arbitrary
lapsus.
Or one can choose arbitrary lapsus.
Well, I left N outside, yeah.
I think N is the last equation.
Yeah, for an homogeneous lapse, if you want.
It means N,
yeah. For cosmology, here it's a two-dimensional configuration space, and there's a Hamiltonian constraint on it. So this is the scalar field, and this is the scale factor and its conjugate variable. So there's two kinetic terms. There's one for the scalar field and one for gravity, which is of the opposite sign. And since it's of the opposite sign, it allows for cosmological expansion. So then we can switch to the quantum cosmology variable, so the connection triad. So they are homogeneous and they're diagonal, and we usually call them C and P. I think C because connection, and P, I have no clue what. And this is the chain of variable, and when you do that, then you see it reintroduce the MZ parameter here. But it's really some artifact of the choice of variables because there's some gamma in the C and P variables. And then I always find it more convenient to work with the volume. So you do another change of variable and you introduce the volume and its conjugate angle. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's here. And so you can rewrite the Hamiltonian constraint in terms of the volume. So of course, it's more convenient for this work since I'm going to focus on the algebra form by the Hamiltonian constraint and its commutator with the volume. So it's simpler to work in these, with these variables. So then you can also compute the complexifier, which is the integral of the triad times the electrostatic curvature, and simply VB. So the volume times its conjugate variable. And it has exactly the same interpretation as for the full theory, is that this is simply the dilatation observable on the phase space for the geometry. So I can focus on the gravitational sector, so simply the gravitational part of the Hamiltonian constraint, and then look at its commutator with V and with C, and its form, as in the full theory, an SL2 algebra. So this is an SL2 algebra that I can rewrite in terms of, well, as an SU11 algebra. So introduce generators, which are a generation of compact rotation, and two boost generators, Kx and Ky. And this is the definition of generators in terms of Cv and H. And it's an algebra which, in our case, has a vanishing Casimir. So the important features here is that the complexifier is a boost, and that the gravitational part of the Hamiltonian is a null generator of the algebra. And so then you will be able to look at the flow of these operators generated by these operators simply as generating SU11 transformations.
So zero Casimir now is the Friedmann equation. This equation that it's a...
Yeah, you can see it as so.
That's the Friedmann
equation. Yes. And at the quantum level, that's what will select the representation of SU11 that you will use to quantize.
I know, but in physical variables, that's Friedmann. I'm asking where is that condition coming from?
Well, the Friedman equation will come from the flow of H.
So where is that equation coming from?
So it's more of this.
So where is the constraints here coming from?
Well, not sure what I can answer, but maybe I will answer it better, like when I here. No, not here. Okay, in 2-3 slides. So the first thing is to look at the action of a complexifier and of a Hamilton constraint and exponentiate them and see what it does. So yeah, just check that here the complexifier generates dilatation on V and B, and that you can reinterpret them in terms of shift of the emisive parameter. So of course you don't see the shift in the emisive parameter when you look at the variables V and B. In that case, when you look at the volume variables, then the Hamiltonian will simply get rescaled, so which is normal in some sense. You take the Hamilton constraint, you rescale your theory, the H equal to zero will still stay, will still give you H equal to zero at the end of the day. But then when you work with the C and P variables, with some gamma, which is encoded directly in the definition of the connection and triad variables, then you will see that these two terms, the matter term and the gravitational term, don't rescale the same way. And there's a rescaling of the emissive parameter that comes in. But yeah, that's not so important. But just to justify that the complexifier does indeed generate shift in the emissive parameter. And then you can look at the I think I put things in the wrong order. I think I erased one of my slides. Okay. So actually, this was the CVH algebra for just the gravitational part. But then you can upgrade it to a closed CVH algebra for the full Hamiltonian, so with matter. In that case, you follow the same kind of definitions. But instead of just taking the gravitational part, you take the whole Hamiltonian constraint. And so you'll have C equal to still the Boost generator, V equal to 1/2 of the null JZ plus KX, and H0, your Hamiltonian, which is equal to KX minus JZ. And in that case, you see that in JZ and KX, you'll have a matter term. And that's going to change you the value of the Casimir. So if you compute the Casimir in that case as this, this is going to be minus pi phi squared divided by 12 pj. So in that case, you see that it's a different Casimir value of a Casimir, which means at the quantum level it will be quantized differently. But you retain the structure that the complexifier is the Boost, and that the full Hamiltonian constraint is going to be given by a null generator. So this allows you to really integrate, like for lapse one, the evolution of your theory. So if you look at the Hamilton constraint, then you exponentiate it, and it's simply some null transformation in SU11, and you can look at its flow on the generator of SU11, so here on the JZ and on the KY, and this is just some quadratic evolution, but actually the Friedman-Robertson-Walker trajectories are very simple. So it gives you the right result. And you can also integrate the scalar field and get everything as usual. But the interesting feature here is that if you look at KY, meaning the complexifier, then you see that it's constant, because this term here is zero once you impose the Hamiltonian constraint. So you have an evolution which is always a constant complexifier. So now I'm going to show that everything works exactly like that in loop quantum cosmology. So in loop cosmology, you introduce a regularization scale, lambda, and you regularize everything by replacing the curvature in terms of finite holonomies of a connection. So in practice, what it means is that you replace B by this kind of by this expression, which is a sine of lambda B divided by lambda, where lambda is the regularization scale. And so you upgrade your Hamiltonian constraint to something like that, modifying the gravitational Hamiltonian. So usually what's done in loop quantum cosmology is that they say that lambda is the emissive parameter up to some numerical factor. Why? Because they say that we've already quantized the theory, loop quantum gravity, and so we know that the basic area excitation is of order gamma. And so I kind of bootstrap my procedure and say that the regularization scale of my theory is gamma times the area gap. But in principle, if you're trying to get the quantum theory with that kind of this bootstrap logic, then you can keep lambda and gamma different. And so that's what's happening here. So I take lambda like that, and I can look at the action of the complexifier on it. So if I look at the action of the standard complexifier, C is equal to VB, it's a dilatation, and I see that this term doesn't really behave well. If I rescale B, the only way to I can keep the same shape is by rescaling lambda. And so in that case, yeah, you do realize that this complexifier relies a shift in the regularization scale, as what happens in usual loop quantum cosmology. But my logic here is that actually this operator, this observable, is not a good observable because it has B. And B has just disappeared from your phase space because you assume it to be that you need to regularize all curvature. So this is not something that is well defined. So you need to regularize also the complexifier. And so how to decide how to regularize this complexifier? Then I use the CVH algebra, and I simply say that as in the standard case, as in the classical theory, I will define my regularized complexifier as the Poisson bracket of my regularized gravitational Hamiltonian and the volume. So it's equal to that simple expression, which you see that when lambda goes to zero, it goes back to the usual complexifier. And then it's still close, it still forms a closed algebra with the Hamiltonian and the volume. And so this is the regularized CVH algebra, which I rewrote here. So here you see this is the extra term that comes, which is different from the standard cosmology. But that can be totally reabsorbed into a redefinition of SU11 generators, which are basically that JZ is the volume, and then the boosts are V times the exponential of lambda IB. Once again, the Casimir is zero, and you can express easily C, V, and H in terms of these generators. So here I introduce a new variable, big V, which is slightly different from small v because it's the one that comes that replaces small v in this formula. So that's the kind of difference, that's the main difference between the standard theory and the regularized theory. So then I can do as I did in the standard case. I can look at the exponential action of a complexifier and of the Hamiltonian constraint. So if I look at the complexifier or any the group action generated by SU2, I will write it in terms of adjoint action. So basically, I can repack my C, V, and H in as a 2x2 matrix, and I will act by conjugation by conjugation on this matrix. So for example, if I look at the evolution at the flow generated by the complexifier, it will be just a conjugation by this simple Hermitian matrix, and it will tell me that V and H transform like that. So the Hamiltonian constraint gets simply rescaled, which is reassuring. So the theory doesn't change our physical content when we rescale, when we do we act with a complexifier, because it's a canonical transformation. But the volume acquires a new term. And that means in some sense that the new volume does not commute with the original volume. So in the quantum theory, it means that if I if I act with my complexifier and get a new complex, I mean, a new volume with a new emissive parameter, it will not commute with the old one. So really, this is the important feature here, is that the volume doesn't get simply rescaled by the complexifier. So now that was the CVH algebra for focusing on the gravitational sector, but as in the standard case, I can include matter in there too. So I will look at the full Hamiltonian, and I will try to close the CVH algebra. And then doing a very simple calculation, you realize that because the volume doesn't get simply rescaled by the complexifier, this term doesn't behave the same way as this term under the action of the complexifier. And so the CVH algebra wouldn't close. So I simply change this factor so that it behaves nicely. And you change it by replacing small v by big V. And that's my regularized Hamiltonian. So what did I do here is that I regularize also the inverse volume factor that appears in loop quantum cosmology. So it's true, if you regularize the gravitational part, maybe you should have regularized also the matter part of a Hamiltonian, of the coupling matter to gravity. And that works basically because the boost along k, ky, which is the complexifier, acts simply as a rescaling of a null direction in SU11. So if you look at the two null direction in SU11, like that, then the Hamiltonian constraint gets rescaled, and the volume, the regularized volume, will get rescaled in the other direction. So as I said, then it forms a closed algebra, SU11 algebra, and the generators acquire not only some terms depending on B, but also some matter term with some regularized volume. So this looks a bit ugly, but if you can also check directly that from this expression that it does form a closed algebra, which is a very nice coincidence, I found. And as in the standard case, you can compute the Casimir of a full CVH algebra with matter and gravity, and you see that the Casimir is given in terms of the matter density. So of course, one of the first things that I had to do is check that it gives the right evolution, what is the modified Friedmann equation and all that. So I took my Hamiltonian given by my Hamiltonian constraint, I set the lapse to 1, and I integrated that, and I said this was my evolution with respect to my coordinate time t. And you can compute this very nice modified Friedmann equation, which is not exactly the one of loop quantum cosmology, but when lambda is close to 0 or close to rho c, then it's almost the same, well, at first order. So it will give you like there's a critical density, and it leads to a dynamics with a big bounce and hyperbolic trajectories. The important point for me is the first little remark that I've put there, that the evolution, all the trajectories are always a constant complexifier. So you've got all your trajectories, and basically the parameter that you distinguish them is the complexifier. So I try to understand this a bit more. And the usual way to look at trajectories in loop cosmology or loop gravity is to deparameterize the system. So that's why we put a scalar field, that we're going to look at the evolution in terms of the scalar field. So I use the scalar field as a clock, and so the matter momentum pi phi is going to be my deparameterized Hamiltonian, giving the evolution, and that deparameterized Hamiltonian will give me the evolution of V and B in terms of the scalar field without reference to my coordinate time. So the nice feature is that both in usual Friedmann-Robertson-Walker cosmology and for the loop regularized version, the deparameterized Hamiltonian is always the complexifier. And that kind of explains why my trajectories were at constant complexifier, because the complexifier is what generates the flow along these trajectories. So actually, that's a simple calculation.
Because earlier you were saying that the complexifier generates measure of transformation of scale.
Yeah.
So now you're saying generate time evolution. So.
Yes. Well, because in cosmology, basically, the evolution is going to be given by a scale transformation.
Right. Scale and time are the same.
Yeah. So in the end, it made sense. But it was still a surprise. Well, a surprise. Solving the Hamilton constraint is something that takes you like half a second. Where is it? OK, you say that equal to 0, and you get pi phi in terms of the rest. And you realize that it's always the complexifier, both in the usual theory or in the regularized theory. So that means that the deparameter evolution is going to be given by the boost action generated by the complexifier that I can compute exactly as I did before for the Hamiltonian constraint. And so the trajectories will be a constant complexifier. It will simply be scale transformations, which you can interpret as shifting the emisive parameter, since the complexifier is the generator of the shifts in the emisive parameter. So that's kind of a big change compared to the usual way we think in loop quantum gravity, where the emissive parameter is fixed, and you try to evolve the states. Now I'm saying that it's completely the diagonal, in the transverse logic to that, it's that the trajectory will change, will make gamma change, and you can even use gamma as the parameter along this trajectory. Yeah?
So far you were just speaking about classical theory.
Yeah.
So but you want to quantize or you don't? Okay. And quantum theory is not supposed to be a unitary transformation. Are you going to comment on that?
Well, here I'm going to say it's a unitary transformation.
Okay. You're going to explain how it's now unitary?
Well, you just take a unitary represent. Well, yeah. But basically, the difference is that, in some sense, usually, what some people say is that, I mean, loop quantum gravity, since gamma will appear as the prefactor in the spectrum, uh-huh. then it cannot be a unitary transformation. Uh-huh. But nobody had written the complexifier or tried to write a complexifier acting on the Hilbert space. So nobody could check whether there was a way to do it in a unitary way. So here, the complexifier does not change the spectrum of the volume.
Okay, so the key thing seems to be for you to change to the volume.
Yes, in some sense. The key here is to make a difference between the regularization scale lambda and the hyperemissivity parameter. Uh-huh. And you see, for example, if I didn't modify the complexifier, and I use the usual complexifier in the modified theory, then it would make shift of a regularization scale. So that one is going to be necessarily a non-unitary operator, which I have no clue how to implement at the quantum level. But if I regularize the complexifier too, then I've got this action of a regularized complexifier at fixed regularization scale. And that's going to be unitary.
So here also the volume spectrum doesn't contain the emissive parameter.
No, it doesn't.
So then this maybe also
answers your question. No, I mean, there's two things going on. One might be the change to the volume, and the other is having an additional parameter.
Yeah, basically, the additional parameter is the size of the holonomy of a little loop you used to regularize, to say that the curvature f was the holonomy.
It's like the mu thing.
Yeah, mu bar. I don't know why I called it lambda. I'm sorry. I should have called it mu bar. So at the quantum level, I've got a SU11 algebra at the classical level. There's no reason why I shouldn't quantize it exactly and why there should be anomalies. So I want the same algebra at the quantum level. So I'm going to represent my theory as a unitary representation of SU11. So these are the action. So a representation of SU11 will be given by a certain value of a Casimir. And I use a basis which diagonalizes JZ, which is the volume, simply. So I'm diagonalizing the volume. And this is the action of the generators. So very similar to SU2. But M now is going to run on all possible integers, positive and negative. But the first condition that I had is that I wanted the Casimir to vanish. Well, actually, there was little things that I didn't have time to explain, that you can put a minimal value of a volume, and then you will shift to a positive Casimir. but that's almost like a detail, is that the only representation that have a vanishing Casimir is of a discrete positive series with the minimal spin J. So like if I, let's come back a bit to representation theory of SU11, you have two different series of representation. You have a continuous one with a negative value of a Casimir and some discrete series with a positive value of a Casimir. Both of them are unitary, and here I will only work with time-like representation, which are they are called time-like because they have a positive Casimir. And in that case, then the volume has a discrete spectrum, which is given by M. It is positive because M is always superior to, is always greater than J. And the volume gap is given by the minimal volume, the minimal value of J, which is the minimal volume, the minimal value of the magnetic momentum M, which is J. So now in that setup, in that Hilbert space, the complexifier will generate unitary transformations. It is a unitary representation. And so you'll get unitary shifts in the Emisi parameter, but which can be also interpreted as a unitary deparameterized evolution. So a nice way to look at the evolution of the quantum theory is to describe everything in terms of semi-classical states. So here we can build coherent states of SU11, which is this very nice thing. So J is the representation, it is fixed, and Z is a pair of complex variables, which is Z0 and Z1. And on these states, you can compute the average values of C, V, and H. So why do I choose these states? It's because they transform very simply under the action of SU11, meaning that if I act with a operator to, an operator in SU11 on the quantum level, it will simply act on the label. So it's some covariant property, which is very nice to describe, to say that basically the quantum evolution is exactly, reflects exactly the classical evolution. And then it satisfies also like a classical Casimir equation, which well, here is not that important. So I can really integrate the action of a complexifier on these Hilbert spaces, and it will be implemented as simply a classical boost action on the label. So now what we have is that we have these states labeled by my pair of variables, and you can act with the boost, and it will give you the trajectories in C2. So C2 is four parameters. Here I didn't have that many degrees of freedom at the beginning. So on these four parameters, one is simply the norm of the state, so I can remove. So I've got three of them. So these three guys are basically will give you the value of C, V, and H. But my trajectories should be determined by I want one parameter less in some sense. That parameter that chooses my trajectory is the value of matter energy density, because here I've looked only at the Grotonian side of the theory. So where's the matter? And the matter, I'm going to say that I'm going to fix Z by imposing these conditions on my states. So this was simply, this is the Casimir equation, that's the same, but the Hamiltonian constraint. So I take the average value of the volume, regularized volume, times the average value of the Hamiltonian, and I say that this gives me the matter density. So this is simply a semi-classical criteria. But if you look at this evolution, then you will see that this number is actually constant along the quantum trajectories. And why? It's because of this semi-classical Casimir equation, but basically the expansion value of a Casimir is fixed along trajectories, because trajectories are a constant complexifier. And so this combination is also constant. And from it, I can reconstruct the matter density. So basically, the whole of the quantum theory happens exactly like in the classical theory. So that was a procedure where I quantize only the gravitational part as an SU11 representation. And then I can use that for simply studying the gravitational sector or to interpret it as the deparametrized theory. But then I could also decide to quantize the full CVH algebra with matter, because it formed also an SU11 representation. So I can do that. And now I'm going to work with space-like representation with a negative Casimir, where the Casimir, the representation is going to be selected by the matter energy density. And then you could build coherent states too. It's a bit more tactical than for time-like representation, but it's fairly straightforward. And you could try to look at the evolution of a complexifier which on the states, which is also easy. And you could look at the flow of the Hamiltonian constraint. But if you look at the full theory, you don't care about the flow Hamiltonian constraint. You actually want to impose the Hamiltonian constraint. So in that case, the Hamiltonian constraint will be given by you want to Jz minus Kx to vanish on the physical states. So you can solve that. This gives some kind of second order recursion relations on the coefficients of a field, of a state. And you realize that actually these physical states are going to be labeled by, are going to be eigenvalues, eigenvectors of a complexifier. So the kind of same thing that was happening in the classical case, that orbits were labeled by values of a complexifier. Now physical states are labeled by eigenvalues of a complexifier. Yeah? So it's all consistent. Where I got totally confused and lost is that I haven't understood at all how from this physical state how to recover a notion of trajectory or anything like that. But I have the physical states, if that's what we care about. So here I've got a few remarks. Is that I can, of course, add a cosmological constant to that. It's the only thing that's going to change is that the Hamiltonian is not going to be of a null generator, but it's going to be time-like, or it's going to be a rotation or a boost, depending on the value of a cosmological constant. This procedure also selects the mu bar regularization scheme over the mu zero scheme, meaning that if I try to do the mu zero regularization of LQC, then the CVH algebra, there's no way to close it. So if you think it's a fundamental algebra, then it selects a one regularization scheme. Then something that I want to explore, but I didn't get to, is to think about what happens if you go to complex values of emissive parameter. So sometimes, very often, we want to set gamma back to I. And in that case, you will be looking at actions of exponential times the operator, the complexifier operator, which you interpret as some terminal state. So terminal state for the deparameterized Hamiltonian. I don't know how to interpret that, but that's something I want to study and understand. So all that was for cosmology. But I don't really care about homogeneous cosmology. I really want to do loop quantum gravity or quantum gravity, not necessarily loop. And so try to understand how I can use this algebra to go local. So the way I was seeing it is that, I can split my space in little bubbles on that. So little region with a boundary, a surface boundary, and then quantum gravity is supposed to tell you what are the degrees of freedom inside each of the bubbles, maybe describe them in terms of just surface state, tell you how these bubbles are connected and how they're going to evolve. Then you can coarse grain things. And so on and so on. And to each of these bubbles, there'll be a CVH algebra associated to that. If you think of it as described by some boundary state, then it will be bound out of the C and, I'm not sure, this is just speculations. So what I want to say is that it looked interesting to me to notice that if I integrate the complexifier on a time-like boundary, on a boundary, it's just going to be the Gibbons-Hawking term. So I want to do something with that. Somehow I feel there's something fundamental there. But then one of the things I was thinking about is how to implement it in loop quantum gravity, because in all I've said up to now, there was no loop quantum gravity. The quantization scheme I did, we don't know if it's going to be loop quantum gravity or not. But is it possible to reproduce the complexifier in loop quantum gravity? So why do I want to do that? It's also because once I have a complexifier, I can try to look for a Hamiltonian operator that will keep the CVH algebra closed. So the complexifier is something that probes the exercise curvature. So the idea I was trying to follow is how to access the exercise curvature in loop quantum gravity. So the exercise curvature, you can actually see it as a torsion of the Hdkar-Barbero connection. So what I mean is that if you look at the Hdkar-Barbero connection, which is the spin connection compatible with the triad times gamma k, then there's some constraint on that. It's the Gauss constraint, which is something like that. But then you can, in some sense, this is the longitudinal component, and there's also a transverse observable, which is the torsion, which is going to be in gamma e wedge k. Well, ek. And so if I want to look at the exercise curvature, I could try to get it through the torsion. So now how can I discretize or understand how to implement that on twisted geometries, for example? So I came back to try to think what do I do with the Gauss constraint? So the Gauss constraint, usually, I implement it around vertices of my spin networks, of my twisted geometries. And I have, for those who don't know twisted geometries, I try to make that brief. You have spinners on all the edges here, which are linked to my vertex. And I build the flux from them, which is Xe, which is the projection of my spinners on the Pauli matrices. And on these, I impose the Gauss law, gauge invariance, a closure constraint, which generates SU2. So now these x's, they don't see the exercise curvature because the exercise curvature is encoded in the twisted angle, so the phase of the spinners. So how do you see this phase of the spinners? That actually the spinner doesn't define only one vector, it defines an orthonormal basis. So you can define other vectors, y and z, which are the real part and the imaginary part of the missile or the rocket. Well, I don't remember how. So where I do this little change here, and I look at the dual spinner. And these guys are some kind of integration over the twisting angle on the whole surface. So what I'd like, this is total speculation again, is to try to look at this guy and to interpret it as a measure of exercise curvature and maybe use it as the integration of exercise curvature on the boundary of my bubbles. So why do I think there's hope in there? Is that if I look at x, y, z, and the total area, and the area, so I look at x, which is the sum of all the x's around my bubble and the same for y and z. Then these guys form an SO32 algebra, which, OK, it's not the SU11 algebra I had, but there's many SU11 algebras in there. So I'm hoping to find to match the two structures in some sense. And to try to see if I can identify the correct generators there, which will produce some kind of boundary CVH algebra for each of my bubbles of my twisted geometries. And that's actually the last thing I'd like to say, but simply underlining the main message is that I'm trying to develop the point of view that the evolution in loop quantum gravity is going to be given by a flow of a complexifier. So a shift in the emissive parameter along the evolution of geometry states. So.
other questions?
So going back to your definitions of the emergency parameter at the beginning, so there's no way one can have an equivalence between some or the definitions?
Hmm?
So is there a way one can have an equivalence between some of these definitions?
Well, sometimes we have the same well, very often they don't have the same effect. So, where is it? Okay, when you start from the action with a coupling constant gamma, then you can try to do the canonical analysis. And if you, depending on how you specify the boundary, and you can recover the usual Achtigar-Barbero connection with the same emisive parameter. But then there was other way to do the canonical quantization by, for example, keeping an SL2C connection and so on, in which case the emisive parameter did not appear. The emisive parameter as a coupling constant didn't appear in the boundary states. So it's possible to make them fit, but often they're not the same. And so for example, in spin forms, you put the coupling constant in maybe it's a more evolved way to see the possible link between the coupling constant and the canonical transformation, but I'm not sure how this works. Is to say that on four simplices, if you impose simplicity constraint on the certain simplicity constraint on the boundary, then the amplitude that you constructed by evaluating the boundary spin network will reproduce some gamma term in the action in the bulk. Else, it's really the only way I see. Yes.
The entropy calculation, which requires gamma to be of a certain value to get the right area relation.
Talking about for black hole entropy?
Yeah, for black hole entropy. I'm just curious what your take on that would be, because if gamma is now...
Okay, then two things. It means that first I'm using, it's only if you use the standard loop quantum gravity quantization. I mean the standard loop quantization. So it means if I follow the logic here, I might not get the same kind of quantization because I might not get the same spectrum for areas and volumes, in which case, I don't know. The second point is that actually that this calculation for the microcanonical entropy, and then there was work more recently by Karim Nui, Alejandro Perez, and others, I think even Mark, where they looked at the canonical entropy in loop quantum gravity and they saw that the leading term didn't depend on the emissive parameter. So you didn't need to fix it to any value to match the usual entropy formula.
These calculations the area spectrum, for example, is done without looking at the Hamiltonian constraint, right? You just do it kinematically.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kinematic observable in the theory. Mm-hmm. So here, because you're taking dynamics into account,
Not really. What was written in the original paper by Abay and Kirill, Alejandro Corici, they assume that for any state on the boundary, there exists at least one physical state in the bulk, whose boundary is given by that, which is reasonable. So it gives it's actually a dynamical calculation. But the point is still, it's a microcanonical calculation. And once these guys went to look at the canonical entropy, there was no need to fix gamma to anything. You always get the 1/4.
Bianca? Well, you talked about getting K. Isn't there also this other way of getting K, where the Poisson bracket of the volume and the key impound of the anatomic constraint?
That's exactly that.
It's exactly, no, okay. What you use there?
Yeah.
Yeah, but can you deduce this way of getting K?
Well, somehow I even need the Hamilton constraint of the complexifier to start doing something. I thought the complexifier was more simple to get.
Uh-huh.
So that's why I'm trying to.
So you define the complexifier as the Poisson bracket of the volume with the regularized Hamiltonian constraint.
Yeah, in cosmology, and
yes.
That's what I want to do here. I want to get a decent guess for what's the complexifier, and then try to make a wild guess of what the Hamiltonian can be if I want that commutation relation to hold.
But in the cosmological case, you did introduce some kind of an additional regularization parameter, lambda, mu bar, whatever.
Yeah.
Because we discussed that. Usually we say it's not unitary incremental. So in the full theory, you expect to do something similar? Or?
Well, yeah, in the two-state geometry, phase space, well, actually, there's no easy parameter. You put it by hand later. Okay, that didn't answer your question. Well, meaning that here, the only way to measure curvature is going around loops. So,
yeah. So
if I want to construct observables or constraint or anything, it will have to be traces of Wilson loops with triad insertion and so on. So in some sense, that's for regularization.
Yeah, but in cosmology, you have this explicit parameter, mu bar.
Yeah. Well.
Which seems to allow you to implement the complexifier unitarily.
Well, I could do it if I was saying that I would be measuring the curvature at that point by the Holmérand little loop. But no, I don't like that. I prefer to not be like create arbitrary loops everywhere and to work on a fixed graph and to try to see. But the equivalent of what would be like here, I work out a theory at fixed regularization scale. Here, it would be I try to work out a consistent theory on a fixed graph and try if it's possible. Not sure, but that's what I'm trying to try. Try to get like loads of CVH algebras on a single two-state geometry graph.
Laurent?
No, it's okay.
So the volume is one of these generators, J
yes.
something.
JZ.
And so the what I didn't get or what I was confused about is it does it now have a discrete spectrum or not?
It has a discrete spectrum.
It has a discrete. But then it should contain the immersive parameter, or it doesn't?
Oh, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
Yeah, the immersive parameter is a parameter eta. That is what I use as to when I try to when I do my exponentiated action of the complexifier. So it's just a flow, a parameter on the orbits.
Right now you're talking
in cosmology, but I'm really hopeful that I can do the same in the full theory.
Well, the algebra that you mentioned at the beginning.
Oh, that's a full theory.
It's in the full theory.
Yeah.
There, did you say that the algebra was something that you understood?
In the full theory, then there's many things. First, I want to redo it, the classical thing, but I need to put a boundary because here I was integrating on the whole hypersurface, but I want the CVH algebra locally. And if I do it locally, I'm sure I have to take care of boundaries. And once I do that, then I'd like to look at the CVH in the discrete, on the two-state geometry, so look at little bubbles around each of those graph vertex. And yeah, there's this structure, which is SO3 too, that we put once in an appendix of a paper with Laurent Simonet because we found that and we had no clue of what to do with it. So I digged it up and yeah, I thought yeah, there's SO3-2 there hidden in some of the observables around each node. I have to do something with it. I want some SU1-1. Should be there. Should be one of these. Yeah. That's like it.
Are there any more questions?
So you want to find an expression where K is localized on the vertices?
Okay. There's two ways of doing that.
And then privately, and that's how you need always two vertices. Let's
Well, I can, if you want. Okay, if you want. Else I can say it very quickly. It's like for the Gauss law. The Gauss law is actually comes in two different places in the theory. It comes as the closure constraint at each vertex, but also as the matching constraint along edges, mm-hmm. saying that the flux here is mapped onto the other flux by the group element. And so here there will be also two ways to probe the torsion. Mm-hmm. Either you look at some integral around the vertex, or you can look at some notion around loops. And in that case, the thing that works better is to look at the product of the holomorphic part of the connection of the group elements around there. Mm-hmm. And that's also a good measure of the ecstasy curvature. Mm-hmm.
In fact, yeah, it always appears when you begin to continue in the phase space continuum as the torsion. It's just that even in the continuum, there's two ways to think about the ecstasy curvature. There's the way that you think if you're a la régie, that you embed it, and then you know the ecstasy curvature is the one form that allows you to transport the along the normal vector. That's usually the way we think. But there's another way, which is canonically, the ecstasy curvature appears as the conjugate variable to the frame field. And in that case, it's a two-form. And this is the one which is the torsion. So as a there's two ways. As a canonical variable, it's a two form. As a geometrical variable, it's one form. And it's in the discrete setting. They both. Anytime you discretize a variable, it should always appear in both ways as the object and its geometry. It's part of discretization.
So, yeah, no other questions, let's thank you.